Our guest today is Dr. Stephen Pelleck from the University of British Columbia. And Doctor, could you give the audience your credentials for us today?
Sure. Thank you, David. I'm actually a professor in the Division of Neurology at the University of British Columbia, and I'm also the president of a biotech company in Vancouver, Kinexus Bioinformatics Corporation. And I'm also the chair of the Scientific and Medical Advisory Committee of the Canadian COVID Care Alliance, which is a network of over 1,000 members, but it's comprised of doctors and scientists and other health practitioners that are really looking into the COVID-19 situation. So I'm coming from there. Much of what I might say is my personal view, but also reflects that of pretty much most of our members. And it does not necessarily reflect the opinions of many of my colleagues at the University of British Columbia. So I should make that clear.
Since the beginning of SARS-CoV-2 virus appeared on the world stage, much has been learned about the virus, and specifically the genome sequence has been identified. So, Doctor, can you explain what that is and why it's important to someone like yourself as a research scientist?
It was disclosed by the Chinese government in around January of 2020, and it was really important for scientists around the world to get that information. The genome is around 30,000 nucleotides long. So a nucleotide is just like a building block to make the actual genome of this virus, which actually encodes about 28 genes. Well, these 28 proteins are created from that genome. And these proteins are basically allowing the structure of that virus. And the one that's the most famous, of course, is the spike protein, which extends out from the surface of the intact virus and gives it this crown-like appearance. That's why they're actually called coronaviruses. And the vaccines that we've been developing, they actually take that gene that's for that spike protein, and it's encapsulated in these vaccine nanoparticles, which is then when you're vaccinated and your cells take up that gene, they actually will make the spike protein in your own cells. And then that's when the spike protein appears on the surface of your own cells. So it actually mimics a virus to your immune system. The immune system attacks it, digests that protein, and presents it in pieces to T cells and B cells that are located in your lymph nodes to make, in the case of the B cells, antibodies against that spike protein. And then when the virus actually comes that you get infected, those antibodies will lock on to the virus, tag it, and allow it to actually be attacked by the rest of the immune system.
What is a variant strain then? So, like, is that an original sequence, the Wuhan strain, and then there's variants that have occurred since then?
That's right. The Wuhan strain would be the one we had the original genome sequence of that virus. And when a virus replicates inside your body, there will be mutations that occur because in the reproduction of the virus, it's not 100% accurate. So you'll get these little changes that occur in the 30,000 nucleotides. Some of those nucleotides will be replaced with a different nucleotide base. And that will result sometimes in a added functionality to the virus, a tiny little fraction. We have to bear this in mind. So when we're looking at something like the Delta strain, which is more infectious compared to the original Wuhan strain, the difference in the overall genome sequence is less than 0.3% of the total 30,000 nucleotides. So it's actually very, very small structural changes, proteins, that allow them to acquire this extra ability to be slightly more infectious. So if we compare the Alpha strain, which was more last year, the virus that was going around, that was about 50% more infectious than the Wuhan strain. And now the Delta strain is about 50% more infectious than the Alpha strain. So we have between the Delta and the original strain, it's about twice as infectious. However, it doesn't seem to be actually more deadly. So it's evolving. In order for a virus to be the predominant strain that's going to be in the community, it has to have two main properties. One, it has to be more infectious. And secondly, it has to be more benign. The virus will really spread best if the person who's infected doesn't realize they're infected, and they go about and do their normal business. And then what will happen is more people will be exposed, and so the virus spreads that much easier. So we have four common coronaviruses that are well documented already that most people in your audience probably have already been infected with in their past. And it gives the colds. These are common cold viruses. They're easily infectious, but they're fairly benign. They don't kill people. They don't get them that sick. That's the way this virus, SARS-CoV-2, is presently evolving into a strain that will be more mild and actually more infectious. And that's normal. That's what we expect viruses to do in a pandemic.
So more infectious doesn't mean more dangerous.
Only in the sense that it'll spread easier. But bear in mind that all of these restrictions that we've applied have been done to try to so-called flatten the curve so that we don't over capacity in our hospitals so that people that need medical care can still get it. The idea with these restrictions was to flatten the curve, but you don't prevent a person from getting COVID-19 ultimately. So our hope was that the vaccination programs would do that, that would give us that immunity that we expected to get if you actually had been infected with the virus and developed your own natural immunity. But what's happening now is these vaccines, they're not actually conferring complete immunity. These are what we would call leaky vaccines. It's still possible if you've been vaccinated to still get the virus and have it propagate in your lungs and airway spaces, and you can still transmit the virus. So this notion that people that are unvaccinated are the major sources of the spread of this virus in our society now is completely misplaced, because as admitted by people like Dr. Fauci at the CDC, a person who gets COVID-19 has a viral load that's pretty much the same as a person who is unvaccinated. If you get sick, regardless of your vaccination status, you can still spread it. Now, the question is, what percentage of the people that are unvaccinated actually have natural immunity now after 2 years into the pandemic? And so what we know is that from the work that we do at my own company, Kinexus, we've estimated from over 2,000 people that we've looked at that it looks close to 80 to 90% of these people have antibodies that recognize the SARS-CoV-2 virus in their bloodstream. Now, that's using our test, which is very sensitive. So the extent of natural immunity in our population is very high, both in the vaccinated and in the unvaccinated. And we know people that were not previously exposed to SARS-CoV-2 and got vaccinated, that they can still get infected and still transmit the disease. So really, the question is, if vaccinated and unvaccinated people can both get and transmit the virus, and we're only restricting the mobility and access to restaurants and other public venues with crowds of people to the vaccinated people, and you're not allowing unvaccinated people in those venues, the bulk of the people that are likely to be transmitting this virus within our society is actually the vaccinated population, not the unvaccinated population, which I understand is completely contrary to the narrative that public health authorities are saying across the country. And that's just incorrect.
Does the Wuhan strain even exist anymore?
Yes, it does, but in terms of being spread around, it gets supplanted by these other strains, which are going to be, again, more infectious and also more benign in terms of their effects.
So eventually they'll become more like the common cold?
Yeah, that's exactly what it's evolving into. And of course, people, what will happen is it becomes endemic in our society. And the people who have been exposed to the earlier strains, they will, in fact, be protected, and they won't develop any symptoms. In fact, the interesting thing is if you look at this virus, a lot of the people who are infected are completely asymptomatic. They have no idea that they were infected. And again, people who are vaccinated, most of them will be asymptomatic as well, and they have no idea that they're infected, and that's why it's so easily spread. But eventually, your society develops herd immunity, and for those that are vulnerable, that for example, they may be immune compromised. Eventually, it's harder for the virus to spread through people to eventually get to them. But you can look at a situation like in India. We had those 400,000 deaths around May and June. And then in the subsequent 4 months, it just plummeted the levels of the case numbers and deaths in India to the point where it's officially not there. And you have to remember that population was only about 11% vaccinated. So it's attributed that this drop is due to essentially the acquisition of herd immunity. 70% of their population is now believed to actually have natural immunity. The good news is that the number of deaths that are actually occurring with this has actually dropped. In fact, between the second wave in Canada around Christmas last year and peak that occurred in Easter time, the third wave, a lot more deaths in those case numbers in the second wave. But the third wave, the death rate dropped dramatically, even though there was large numbers of cases. And we seem to have a similar situation now in the fourth wave, where there are deaths, but they're relatively small number of deaths. Now contrast that to the situation in Israel, where about 90% of their adult population was actually double vaccinated by the end of, certainly in March. And they experienced a period where there was very low numbers of cases and certainly deaths. Then got a peak in the summertime, which is still ongoing, as high in case numbers as their pre-vaccination peak. And they had a very significant death peak as well at the same time, which we don't see in Canada. We don't see it really in the United Kingdom. Other places that, you know, also affected by the Delta variant. So we're all talking about the same variant. In Israel, they had no very high death peak. So now in Israel, most of their population is now triple vaccinated. And publications that come out are really showing that if you're triple vaccinated, you're 10 times less likely to be hospitalized than if you're double vaccinated. So that tells you that these vaccines actually lose their efficacy. It was primarily the Pfizer vaccine, and they are preparing to do a fourth shot if necessary. Right now, it's too early to tell whether immune memory is going to be established with a third shot. And then the question is, well, is there a problem from doing repeated vaccinations like this? Are the health risks of that outweighing the concerns related to the virus and its lethality and cause of sickness? We don't know. We just don't have the data at this point.
And doctor, with the different SARS-CoV-2 vaccines, we hear about different statistics regarding efficacy. We hear titles like relative risk reduction and absolute risk reduction, absolute efficacy in the same paragraph. And these often refer to percentages which can range from 1% to 95%. Maybe take the Pfizer vaccine research and interpret that for us in layman's terms.
First of all, everything that you've heard in the mainstream media is relative risk reduction. And they just don't say relative. What that means is, let's say you have 50,000 people that are in the group that is vaccinated and 50,000 people in the group that's unvaccinated. How many people at the end of the day get COVID-19 in both groups? And you might find something like 100 people end up getting COVID-19 in the group which is unvaccinated, and 5 people get it in the group which is actually vaccinated. So you have 95 people that are less than you would have expected if they were unvaccinated. So that would be called like a 95% reduction, 95% relative risk reduction. However, the FDA, when we're talking about efficacy for drugs or risk reduction in the case of vaccines, they do not recommend using relative risk reduction terms because it gives you a false sense of the efficacy of the treatment that you're doing. So they refer instead to absolute risk reduction. And that's important because let's say you're doing a program for vaccination and you want to know if we vaccinate everyone in our population, how much are we going to actually reduce the occurrence of, in this case, COVID-19 cases? So there we look at absolute risk reduction. So in the case of one group, we would have had 100 people out of 50,000 that would have, in fact, gotten infected. And in the other group that was vaccinated, we have 5 out of 50,000. So what you do is you look at the percentages in those two groups and you subtract them from each other. So if we use actual Pfizer data and assume that it's correct in terms of who was actually getting COVID-19 and that. That's questionable. It's also questionable, by the way, whether or not the people that were in those groups actually had natural immunity in the first place. We don't know. Assuming that their data is correct, based on what was published, after a 3-month study, they found that the absolute risk reduction was 0.7% by being vaccinated versus being unvaccinated in terms of absolute risk reduction in the population.
0.7%. Now, what does that mean?
It's barely statistically significant. But what makes it worse is that a study came out just recently where Pfizer presented their data from a 6-month study. And I've actually calculated the absolute risk reduction for that. And it's 0.2%. So basically, after 6 months, if you follow the protocols with Pfizer that you get vaccinated and then follow up a month later with vaccination, that you can expect about 6 months later that you will have reduced the occurrence of COVID-19 in that population by 0.2% than what it would have been otherwise.
Oh, okay.
Now, the question is, if you're told that, oh, I'm going to get 95% reduction in my risk if I get vaccinated, you think, well, that's a no-brainer. Let's just go ahead and get vaccinated because it seems like I'm reducing my chances of getting infected by 20-fold. But actually, that's not true at all. You're actually reducing your chances of getting infected by 0.2%. Then the question is, that's the reward of that reduced risk of getting the COVID-19. But then what comes with it? And that's where we talk about vaccine injury. It's another story.
Pfizer also did another study of biodistribution. Can you explain what that study revealed?
This data was uncovered through the efforts of Byron Bridle, who's a member of the Canadian COVID Care Alliance. And he was able to get data that was released through Freedom of Information Act equivalent that's in Japan to see the Pfizer data that was filed to health authorities. And we were able to look at that. He shared it with the rest of us in our scientific and medical advisory committee. And the way the experiment was done, because you can't do this with people, they actually didn't even use the actual Pfizer vaccine that's injected into people, but they used the same nanoparticle, the delivery system. So these nanoparticles, they can make them radioactive. And so what happens is when they inject rats with these, we do what we call biodistribution studies. Where did that radioactivity go? And that's a reflection of where did those vaccine nanoparticles go? And they found that when they injected it into the rats, at the site of the vaccination, what happens is after 2 days, it turns out that only 26% of the original nanoparticles are actually left at the muscle where the vaccine was injected into the rat. It spread through the rest of the body, and it accumulated primarily in the liver, the spleen, the adrenal glands, and the ovaries. Now, in terms of overall distribution, maybe it's only 1% roughly in those various organs, but bear in mind that those organs have different sizes, and so the ovaries are very small compared to, for example, the liver. So what happens is you can determine the concentrations of those nanoparticles, and so it turns out that, for example, in the ovaries, we're approaching concentrations that are about half as high as at the original site of the injection of the nanoparticles in the first place. So it does appear that we get accumulation in certain organs at concentrations which we know are allowing, at the site of injection, the production of the spike protein on the surface of those cells. We would expect the same to be true for these other organs that are picking up the nanoparticles as well. So we would expect that they would be producing the spike protein inside the cell and presenting it on the surface of those cells and evoking immune reactions at those other sites. That's a concern. We have very little actual data in people in this regard because, you know, with this sort of Operation Warp Speed to get these vaccines out, a lot of the original safety studies were just not performed, or they just weren't performed very well. And that's our major concern, is we just don't have good data on this. And so now we're seeing vaccine injury, and we're trying to explain what's going on when we try to put the pieces together, it becomes clear that these nanoparticles do spread. The spike protein does last for at least several days, maybe even a month in some people, and you will have reactions from essentially expressing this pathogenic protein, part of the virus that causes the most damage when you're infected with the SARS-CoV-2 virus itself in COVID-19. Well, we're actually putting this into people, and its pathogenic properties are being also expressed in vaccinated people. And this is of major concern.
If the vaccine is supposed to be of benefit, how can there be adverse effects, or how can there be injury as a result of this injection when it's supposed to be helpful to us?
What ends up happening is when the nanoparticles are delivering that RNA, or in the case of the adenovirus vaccines, delivering the DNA, which makes the RNA, you're actually making the spike protein inside those cells. The spike protein is then presented on the surface of those cells. It's actually anchored, so it stays there. And so you're taking your own body cells and making them actually look like a virus. So you have cells that are in your immune system, part of your innate immune system, which includes macrophages and neutrophils and cells of this kind, which actually will attack that cell. They'll kill that cell. And in the process of the attack and digesting pieces of the proteins that are in that cell, including the spike protein, those pieces are actually inside those immune cells and then presented on their surface, called MHC antigens. And then when these cells move to the lymph nodes, where the T cells and the B cells are located of your immune system, the B cells are the ones that make antibodies. And they have on their surfaces these antibodies. And if it turns out that they have a binding affinity for that portion of the virus protein, then what will happen is it stimulates that B cell to grow and divide, and eventually to a colony of identical cells that have an antibody that's identical from each of those that will lock on to that structure, that portion of that virus protein. So these antibodies that are being pumped out from these cells that will be in your circulation, they'll lock on to the virus by binding to that part of the protein that's on the virus surface and tag it so that the immune system can recognize it, the other innate immune cells, to better attack it. It acts almost like a beacon, and then that's what destroys the virus. Now, the problem is this, that when you have that inflammatory response where you're attacking your own body cells, you'll also be digesting your own proteins. And those proteins, in fragments presented with MHC antigens to your B cells and T cells, you will actually break what we call immune tolerance. So what'll end up happening is you get the development of antibodies that recognize your own body proteins. Normally, these are eliminated early on in your development, but you can break that tolerance by repeated inflammatory reactions against your own tissues. We know this is the mechanism by which we get autoimmune diseases like arthritis, type 1 diabetes, lupus, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, colitis, the list goes on. So we know that people, as they get older, can start developing autoimmune diseases, and this is actually the basis for a lot of the morbidity that we have in our population. These are experimental vaccines. We have no real sense of the risk that can occur in terms of autoimmune diseases. Now, we do see with myocarditis, this is an inflammatory response against your heart. And so probably happening is these nanoparticles are getting into the heart. Probably the spike protein is being expressed, or it could be microclots that are being put through thrombosis is the other alternative mechanism. And what's happening is the heart cells are dying. They're not getting either enough oxygen or there's an inflammatory response. And when you have death of cardiomyocytes, heart muscle cells, they cannot be replaced. So what we're seeing is that for people that are under 24, the public health office in Ontario acknowledged that your chances, if you're taking the Moderna vaccine, of getting myocarditis is about 1 in 5,000, especially in males. And this seems to be happening a lot in people that are very athletic, again, because they're probably really pushing their bodies with some cases of actual death. Certainly for most cases, it's going to be a lifelong injury.
So, Doctor, let's take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation.